Welcome to Farmer Talk Radio. This podcast is focused on addressing the current market and investment trends in immuno-oncology from the 2023 Immuno-Oncology 360 Summit. For more information on the IO 360 conference, editorial, podcasts, or webcasts, visit io360summit.com or theconferenceforum.org. Thank you and enjoy the podcast.
And again, good morning, everyone. Good to see you all back for the third day of IO 360. As you see, we are changing gears a little bit, moving into investment topics and, you know, the markets. What Andrew just kicked us off with was insightful, quite interesting to see how, things are viewed. And there are different perspectives. I'm not going into that right now. But, you know, in principle, I'm curious to hear other perspectives here from our experts from either the banking or the investment community. So we'll start with introductions, and Rajiv is just coming. So good to see you. Good morning. We'll do quick introductions and then kick us off with a few questions for the panel and invite you to also ask a few questions at the end. So why don't we begin on the left. Rajiv.
I'm Rajiv Kaul. I manage the biotech fund at Fidelity. I've been investing in the space when Genentech first came public, before it was acquired, and then it came public back, I think it was in 1999. I don't want to date myself, but I don't know if a long-term perspective, historical perspective, is helpful or hurtful, because things are changing so fast. But it's been an exciting journey over the last almost three decades in the space. So, yeah, I've seen a lot of these companies. Gilead was a $250 million company. Now it's like $85 billion. It's been a wonderful thing to watch the space grow. I would also say that I'm very excited about where the innovation is today, and particularly excited about the macro recession as from an investment perspective, and we can talk more about that later.
Yeah.
Fidelity is probably the largest investor in the biotech, among the largest in the world, and has a unique position because they're one of the few institutions that takes a very long-term fundamental view. The goal is to own the breakthrough drugs, best management teams, best capitalized companies, and try to own it for the long term, which often leads to owning it for over a decade. Philosophically, that's quite a unique platform to be part of.
Certainly, biotech has come of age. Thanks for joining us. Albert.
Hi, everybody. Albert Huang. I'm a managing director, and I head the healthcare group at Morgan Stanley on the coverage side in investment banking. Like Rajiv, I've been in the industry for quite a while. I started in 1999, did not see the Genentech IPO, but did work on IPOs like Alnylam back in the early 2000s. I'm a physician by training, but have been a banker my entire life. Have had the pleasure to see the biotech industry ups and downs, most recently in the 2020-2021 ups, which I think was a very busy time for all of us, and happy to be here, looking forward to this discussion. Thanks.
Thanks for joining us. Irina.
Hi, good morning. Irina Margina. I'm a private biotech investor at Wellington Management, so I'm not affiliated with MD Anderson. it's a pleasure to be here this morning. I haven't been in the industry for quite as long as Rajiv and Albert have. I've joined Wellington about 4.5 years ago after spending some time on the sell side, and I joined to start our first biotech dedicated private fund. We're now investing out of Fund 2. This is, under the Wellington umbrella. Wellington itself is probably as big, almost kind of an investor Our public book of business is extremely large, and you know, share the philosophy that Rajiv described for Fidelity as well. I think my perspectives are going to be a little bit different because I spend my time, you know, talking to small private companies that are sort of at the forefront of innovation and. I couldn't be more grateful to, you know, have the opportunity to be an investor at this moment in time, just given the speed of innovation and depth of understanding that we have these days.
Fantastic. Thanks for joining us. So, you know, we will start with a few questions to the panel and then open up the floor for questions through the audience. I'll begin with a very simple question. You know, you just heard Andrew Baum with the perspective of I.O. For the last year or so since the last IO 360. I will pose that similar question to you now. What do you think was the most, you know, impactful event that occurred in the last 12 months since we had this panel? And, you know, interestingly, we predicted a bit of a difficult market scenario a year ago, and unfortunately that played out exactly as we had predicted. Maybe that will be different this year. Hopefully it will be different this year. But I'm curious to hear your opinions. What was the most important event last year over the last 12 months? And we will come to a future prediction after that. So, Rajiv, do you want to kick us off?
I think to me the most significant event was not necessarily related to the fundamentals in the broad biotech industry and even to specifics within the oncology space or the IO space. It was the macro economy and cost of capital, perceptions of risk, the Fed raising rates more aggressively than it's done in the last 50 years as a consequence of some of the excesses that occurred during the COVID period. And so I think that has led to an extreme correction in publicly traded stock prices. In many cases, these stock prices are cheaper than they've been in the history of the industry. If you look at the cost of R&D, it's been the amount of how much you're paying for R&D in these stock prices, it's below what you were at the bottom of the dot-com bust. You know, at some points in 2022, that was the case. At one point, I think a third of the biotech industry was trading at a negative enterprise value, so which has never been seen before. So from a long-term investor perspective, it's probably not been a more exciting period in the last several decades. Clearly, the fundamental risks broadly for the industry remain very high. Most drugs fail. There's a lot of questions on the translational side, as we all know. That hasn't changed. You still got to invest in companies with a high probability of success, breakthrough drug that really adds value to patients and payers. It's not an easy thing to do, but there's many ideas there. In an environment where the prices are 70-80% below where they were a year or 2 years ago, you have to believe that that is a major opportunity for on the investment side. And typically when you come out of these macro downturns like we've had in the last 12 months, the next generation of leading companies, the most innovative companies, find a way to emerge and stand out for themselves. This has happened over and over again. You can go back to the 2016 downturn around a political environment, around drug pricing. You can go back to 2008, 2009. Post the dot-com crash, and the leaders of the companies that we see today all came out of those downturns. This is also true, I think, broadly in technology, in the technology sectors as well. So given that macro backdrop and the everything on sale mentality and the risk-averse nature of the investment universe these days, that clearly stands out as the most fundamental event, if you would call it that, over the last year.
All right, yeah, fully agreed with that. Albert, what's your thinking?
Yeah, so I'll go one level closer to biotech and pharma I think in the last 12 months, what's been most significant, or maybe has not even hit yet in people's minds, is the Inflation Reduction Act, which I think was put out in mid-August. And there's all sorts of proposed rules, lots of effects that are going to take place, many of which people are speculating on and what's going to impact the revenues of top Medicare drugs. That's going to take place over the next 10 years or so, and it's going to have a significant impact on pharmaceutical revenues. That all trickles down to biotech and innovation, and the specific rules around IRA that are being proposed will cause pharma to change its views on what they find interesting. It'll cause biotech to change its views on how they run clinical trials, and it will change, you know, patient care and who gets what kinds of drugs. I think the impact of that is already being felt. If you look at an index of rare disease companies versus non-rare disease, since August, rare disease is up about 7%, and anything non-rare is down about 5%. So I think investors are starting to realize that single indication rare disease is protected, whereas multiple indication life cycle management drugs are going to be impacted by the IRA. I think the major, one major milestone that's going to happen is on September 1st of this year, the government will come out with its list of top 10 drugs, and then that list will trickle down into the sell-side research reports on which drugs will lose a lot of revenue, and that will then factor into what happens to pharmaceutical companies' EPSs, which will impact their PEs and their overall valuations. So I think that you know, we'll start to see things in the fall that will be a pretty good reality check on drug pricing.
Yeah, I'm going to be super quick. I'm just going to say that I think we're already seeing some of the impacts of these aspects on the company creation side. You know, capital is more expensive than it's been in a long time, and the impact of that is already being seen in the way early stage investors are thinking about building these companies and the way they think about, you know, platform versus asset, or like strategically prioritizing the indications that they're gonna go after. So we've definitely seen already a shift there, and then. On the IRA, if you look at the companies that have been, you know, created in the later part of last year, I mean, obviously very, very early data points, but it already appears that there's been an impact on small molecule company creation as people think about the ultimate value of these assets, you know, down the line. We'll have to see how that evolves.
All right, well, thank you. Good perspectives. Let me switch gears and go a little bit broader, beyond this individual events. You know, how do you view the state of affairs for immuno-oncology specifically today? If you think about it that way, in 2011, we really kicked off this space, even though we have had decades of investigations, particularly cancer vaccines, without success, unfortunately. We had the first real successful compound, ipilimumab, that really drove the evolution of the IO space. We have had a lot of success in the last decade than we had last year. What do you think is the state of affairs of IO today? And we will talk about the future then towards the end of this conversation.
Do you want to start?
I'll start. I mean, I think we've made amazing progress and still have so much to work on, and obviously we've seen a lot of ups and downs and setbacks on, you know, novel targets, and particularly in the combo approaches that have been tried and so on. But I would say, I mean, from my perspective, we've made amazing progress on the new modalities. You know, CAR-Ts have change the standard of care in hematologic cancers. We've seen great progress in the T-cell engagers, more recently TCRs or TCRTs, and ADCs have also transformed the patient experience for many cancers. So it's quite amazing to look over the past decade and see all that progress.
Yeah, I think from the investment banking perspective, IO still has a ways to go, mostly because investors kind of look at the last few years of innovation and some of the setbacks that we've had. And when you look at the setbacks, it makes it difficult to take private companies public. And some of these setbacks are pretty prominent, like IDO, and that probably still resonates among investors, where you look at a private company and they're running a trial that is in combination with PD-1, but not doing a monotherapy trial. And so that gets met with skepticism, because people then start to wonder, which drug is having the most effect. And since we don't fully understand or can quantify the effect, companies that are running combo therapy as their lead indication or lead trial don't get as much credit as they should from investors. So often they're put in this situation where they have to do the monotherapy trial first, and that has less of an impact clinically. And therefore, you need to be longer, private longer, in order to show an effect that gets the public markets interested. So I think from a capital markets perspective, there is more of a show-me effect on an IO company than there is on a non-IO company. From the strategic side, separate from capital markets, it depends on the pharmaceutical company on what they're interested in. Some are very interested in super late-stage assets, de-risked, so they're going to wait until phase three data. Some of them just like a particular mechanism. So you take a company like Merck, if you look at their acquisition history, they're willing to buy things in phase one and phase two because they like a mechanism. You take other companies that are only interested and will put in a bid for a company after it's finished with its phase three trial. So it's very different from that perspective. But as an IO company, the conundrum that you're in is clinical trials are more expensive than if you have an orphan indication, and you have to do these combination trials with PD-1, so your cash burn is higher. And all of that, you still have to be private longer. So that kind of makes it more difficult to be an IO company in the early stages.
My view is I'm quite disappointed with the whole space. And I'm frustrated that the progress is not fast enough. I was just looking at this. There's 600,000 people in the United States that died from cancer last year. In the last, it's almost 2,000 people a day. That's far greater than the impact that COVID has had on mortality in the United States. I think the progress has been frustratingly slow relative to what I was hoping for a decade ago. I was an investor in Medarex and Organon, and didn't really necessarily foresee the PD-1 story, but when it occurred, there was a lot of hope that the hypothesis that T cells can have remissions, prolonged remissions in solid tumors is a major opening. But since then, we were early investors in Juno and Kite. They worked out as good investments. But beyond CD19 and now maybe BCMA, it's not much else that you can point to. Sure, there are some targeted therapies and certain mutational, oncogenic drivers. Those patients are having the sort of derivative of Gleevec. But even there, I'm a little frustrated that there's like four companies going after Rett, and there's only so many patients in the world with the disease. So I think it's a symbol of hitting a wall. I'm hopeful maybe there's something with some of these next generation programs that we've discussed. It feels to me the complexity of diagnosis and treatment, we're still very early in figuring out the nuances there. I'd like to be hopeful when we go to science meetings like this. I'm always very excited because there's all these great science presentations that talk about neoantigens and the dark matter producing the possibility of being able to see things in tumors that we haven't seen before, opening up a whole new possibility there. There's definitely great advancements in science, the ability to perceive nature at a dynamic atomic resolution. The hope there and the possibilities are tremendous. So we're making progress. I don't want to be down on that, but I also don't want to have my head in the sand. We're not solving the problem in any major way as of now, and I hope I'm wrong, but it's in the next decade, I'm not sure if it's maybe something like the cancer vaccines could change that, but we still need more definitive data. But most of it's going to be, you know, adding another 5% of patients to the existing patients that respond to PD-1, and that just doesn't impact all our lives in a very fundamental way, or society on a broad level, addressing the costs and the mortality issue. I think we could do much better.
Yeah, so I appreciate that perspective, and I will dare to add one of my own to this. IO is more complex than targeted therapies, for example, where you have a mechanism, you go after that particular mechanism, if you hit it, you have an effect. That may not be curative, but it actually can be transformational. We have seen many new medicines, the ADCs that Andrew referred to earlier certainly fit in that category. Now, IO is a complex circuitry of immune mechanisms. They're interlinked. If you hit one, you have ripple effects on others. The net effect is hard to predict. It's more complicated. And you know what I had anticipated in 2011 after Ipi got approved, and we saw the emergence of the PD-1 wave. I didn't necessarily expect PD-1 to be that big. That was hard to see. But it's fantastic that it happened. I would have expected after that we need to recalibrate. This PD-1 was a gift. It couldn't have been just planned for. And I think the next wave is going to come. The question is, when will it come? And can we achieve the same transformational effects that we have seen with some other mechanisms? I think we can, but companies need to recalibrate. They need to think about targets differently. BCMA and CD19, yes, sure, but that's liquid tumors. It's a smaller group of patients. There's a lot more that we need to do, and we have tools to actually do more. We're just not giving enough emphasis to those tools. TCRs are the next thing that can address intracellular targets, then you might actually be able to push this into the solid tumor space. Then you need to deal with the tumor microenvironment. The complexity is higher. You need to add on other components into these T cells to make them more durable and make them more, less fatigued and so on. There's many things one needs to do, but you can see what needs to be done. We just need to put the right emphasis on it. Instead of doing 1,000 PD-1 combo trials with unclear mechanism, let's put double down on TCRTs or the things where we have a higher probability of getting that transformation effect. So that's my perspective. Of course, no individual player can do this alone. This has to be more of a coordinated effect. And large pharma can help here because large pharma has more resources, can bring things together that could actually help. So I'll just, my perspective.
I like your perspective. A frustrating part about large pharma's approach to this is what you referred to, which is it's not on the cutting edge of innovation. It's the costly large trials and being the second or third or fifth or tenth PD-1 player. The TCR work is being done by small innovative biotech companies, many of which might be in this room. We talked about Medarex, Organon. They were small biotech companies that no one cared for the longest time. Kite and Juno and the work done by Steve Rosenberg had the same history. TILs, no one cares about, quite transformative for some patients. So I think there's a mismatch between where the capital is being deployed in the industry and where the true innovation is. I think the current capital cycle definitely doesn't help that. And it's frustrating to watch this. I definitely don't want to sound too negative about, you know, the challenge here, because I do understand the difficulty of cracking this problem. But these are some of the elements that you've highlighted that need to operate at a higher level together to be able to kind of push that innovation.
Transformational medicines has to be the name of the game.
Yeah, I think I hate to also be more negative, but I think the issue with the government getting involved, and this is why everyone should lobby against this, is they're favoring biologics over small molecules. So 13-year life versus 9-year life for small molecule. And, you know, you take that and all of the PD-1 patent expiries that are going to happen at Merck, Bristol, and on down the line, you end up with a situation where the large cap companies in the back half of this decade are going to have a significant amount of revenue loss. And so they need to fill that. And the best way to fill that is with small molecule. So you have a government putting pressure on where the revenue needs to be made up, which is going to be blockbuster small molecule.
Going to go after the GLP-1 category. You're going to have like 20 of those to try and make up the $200 billion loss.
Yeah, everybody.
To your point, it's that herd mentality that's very frustrating to watch.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is these clocks start when you get your first indication approved. So you have this perverse incentive now where instead of going after third line and then second line and then first line, you hold back your approvals for second and third line until you get first line data, if you even get that. Now, the good thing about IO is typically when you're in combination with PD-1, you're going after earlier lines anyway. So that may be better than other modalities. But it does create this incentive where if you can only, your clock starts with your first indication approved, you're going to go after the biggest market first. You're going to jack up your prices as high as you can. And then you may launch in Europe before you launch in the U.S. just because you don't have the rules that you have here. So in effect, the government has created this act that is almost like the tax code, where you look at the rules and you figure out how to get around it. And that is bad for innovation. I think, as I said, it's good for IO because they are typically kind of earlier lines. So you can go after something, more first line and bigger revenues for the large caps. And as I mentioned, the pressure of PD-1s going off patent means that they're really looking for the next wave of combination therapy or add on to PD-1 to bolster their revenues.
Yeah, so maybe we should switch gears here on that perspective and look a little bit about into how do private versus public investors view the current market trends. So Rajiv, if I begin with you, from the perspective of a public investor, how do you see the IO space right now?
It's difficult for me to make a broad statement there, because the way I look at this is, one molecule at a time. And it can be in the IO space, it could be in targeted oncology, it's beyond oncology. I'm looking for transformative drugs that common sense investing, and we're all trying to do that, transformative drugs that can work through the payer environment, really impact patients' lives. And one of the things that I'm challenged by these days related to the conversation we've had is on competition. Whenever you do find that target or you do find that modality, you're going to have three CD19 CAR Ts, very hard to differentiate between them, four red players, and that makes it tough in general from a public markets perspective to be, and I think maybe from a private perspective too, because on the private side, you actually don't even know what's going to emerge necessarily in the next year or 3 years from now. And the private investors seem to have a lot of money these days. And so they kind of can throw money at a lot of things and often be the second or third in a market and try to claim that they have a tweak on the chemistry that might be this game-changing impact. And you just don't know until you run the trials, but there's a story to be made there. So to answer your question more specifically, I feel like I'm excited about the environment because the prices are all low. As an long-term investor, I'm working for my shareholders. It's like any other investment field. You want to buy value. I'm a value investor in biotech. I take the long term. So I feel like I have a lot of ideas right now. I can't talk about specific companies, unfortunately. I'm not allowed to. Otherwise, I would happily do that. So I'm very excited when I wake up every day and I see cheap prices. I met a company yesterday in the hallway that's trading at a negative enterprise value. We have two programs in the clinic. There's some real promise there for multi-billion dollar drugs. And that's really exciting me. I'm going out and doing the work and, you know, would like to make a significant investment in the company if everything pans out. So I'm seeing a lot of opportunities like that. I don't need that many. There's about over 1,000 public biotech companies there. You only need 10 or 20 at the most, a handful, that you can own over the next decade to have an outstanding returns. And there's many companies where, as a public investor, you can get venture type investment returns today for whatever reason. You know, I don't think they've got to do with the fundamentals of the company. They've got to do with technical reasons in the stock market, like raising interest rates or being put in an ETF or some ETF sold, you know, being thrown out of the Russell 2000 small cap index. And these companies tend to be less liquid. So there's these technical factors that have created huge disparities between the price of the stocks and the real fundamental value, what I think could be 20, 30 times higher for some of these companies than where they're trading today. And investors are not paying attention broadly, I think, to the space. So to answer your question, IO, there are a few IO companies there in the mix, like the one I mentioned that I met with yesterday. But this doesn't change the fundamental sort of theme of this conference, I think, which is that, where are the big transformative PD-1 type molecules? And to your point, Axel, there will be a second wave, but when's that happening?
When is that coming? Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. Irina, do you want to add a perspective on from the private side?
Yeah, I need a healthy dose of optimism to be able to wake up in the morning and do my job. So I'm trying to focus on that. Joke aside, I think we continue to see, capital flowing into IO on the private market. Plenty of it. A lot of it has moved away from necessarily looking for new targets. Many times that's unfortunately difficult to fund, at least on its own. I think it would have to be in the context of a broader pipeline for investors to be willing to be very bullish on a program like that. It's very difficult with limited data, and we can talk more about that. But I think where we're seeing a lot of effort and capital going towards are things that are building upon, the progress that we have made. And I think, for CAR-Ts, for example, as you mentioned, liquid tumors were easier. I think now people feel like we have the knowledge and the tools to attempt to, expand the scope to solid tumors by building all of these armed CAR-Ts and so on that might be able to withstand the tumor microenvironment and so on. And then on the logistics side, there's efforts obviously to make this modality a little bit more easier to commercialize and use things like in vivo CAR Ts or the allogeneic CAR Ts. Obviously, those have taken quite a setback this year, but still efforts there. And then, you know, for TILs, I think that we have data now that speaks to the fact that that's, you know, a very active way of going after some of the solid tumors. The first generation drugs have plenty of issues, but there are like next generation attempts to kind of come up with better TILs or better ways of making these TILs, for example. And then the TCR space has had like quite a bit of momentum in the past 2 years, like data from like companies like Immatix and Adaptimmune and the approval of the Immunocore drug. So now we're seeing many companies trying to come up with different like ways to do TCR mimetics and or you know different ways of like making these drugs. So I think there's still effort and plenty of it. Even cytokines, it's like still a very there's been a lot of ups and downs, but there's still a lot of creative ways that people are trying to. You know, to be able to kind of leverage that biology, which we know is very strong, it's just that it's been very difficult to drug.
All right, so you're saying there is still plenty capital on the private side to invest in exciting science.
There's more capital on the private side than there's ever been, but there's definitely plenty of it is still going towards IO or IO-related spaces, yeah.
Very good. So then we never have enough time for conversations like this. So we will be running out soon. I want to pose one more central question, then open up for the audience, and I pose that to Albert. You know, thinking about private equity, large cap companies, and business development being the lifeblood for many biotechs, and you know many of them seeking still either partnerships or an exit. How do you see that perspective now? You know, M&A has been a big talked about topic. It hasn't really materialized last year. What do you think is going to happen?
Yeah, I think from a strategic side and how the large companies look onto the smaller companies, there was the PD-1 issue I brought up earlier where a lot of them are going off patent, and there's five or six of them out there with another, probably half dozen to come. So everybody wants to be in oncology. And if you don't have a PD-1, you have to go get one. So Gilead did a deal with Arcus to get a TIGIT, but they also get a PD-1. And in some ways, you do that so you don't have to buy Keytruda at retail. So there is a strategic angle to owning many drugs in the space, or at least having the rights to it. I think that pressure of PD-1s either going away because of LOEs causes them to do more combination trials, and they're thinking back half of the decade, so there's still 4 or 5 more years to go before they have to have a drug on the market. And so the investment from large caps into small caps is going to continue to be strong. In some ways, many companies have gone public and then the markets went away and they had to go find alternate sources of capital. So you look at a company like iTeos, which has a TIGIT. They found a big partner and now they have cash through 2026. And so that allows you to continue development without deviating from your original plan due to capital. You know, you don't want to be constrained by capital when you see the innovation there. So I think long-term bullish from the perspective that there's a lot of innovation going on. From the large cap perspective, they're willing to take those kinds of bets because they're partnerships and not outright acquisitions. So I think the capital, not only from the investor side, but also from the strategic side, is going to be there.
All right, very helpful. So then we have a few minutes left. I will open it up for the audience to collect a few questions. I see Greg lining up, so please.
Greg Savanovich, Mizuho Securities. Good to see everyone. Thanks, Axel, for hosting this panel. This audience has a lot of entrepreneurs and companies that are struggling to find capital in this current environment. So maybe this question is either for Albert or Irina, just in terms of what advice you would give to small companies either trying to do a Series A, Series B, they're kind of at the throes of where we are in terms of sentiment with the market. Thanks.
I can start just really briefly. I mean, I think a lot that has been discussed, you know, kind of spoke to why development in IO is difficult. And everyone knows that, preclinical models don't translate well to clinical success, and these, you know, targets and pathways are not necessarily well conserved across species, and clinical trials are hard to run, and combo data is difficult to interpret. So I think these are issues that are well known by everyone, but they are, I think, particularly relevant for early stage investors because they need to make these decisions based on very limited data. And so I think maybe some things that companies could keep in mind is that the more you can relate to human biology, early on, the better, be it through, you know, patient samples and, like, epidemiology data, whatnot. One thing that investors don't like is, like, orthogonal risks. So if working on a new target that has a lot of risk, you know, maybe try to minimize the modality risk that you take and vice versa. I think it's never too early to think about, like, biomarkers and ways to segment patients and so on. So from my perspective, these are some things that, you know, could be helpful at those early stages of a Series A or a Series B stage company.
Maybe just carrying the baton from Series B and into the public markets, I think if you look at the IPO performances for the past few years, it's been pretty dismal. And even within IO, it has not been great. Now, the thing I would say is that's because many companies were probably taken public too early. So before you have any proof of concept, just because you can go public, a lot of the early stage investors are pushing them out for liquidity purposes. I would suggest getting as much money as possible in the Series A, Series B, and getting to some sort of proof of concept where you have a bit of clinical data, and that will prevent you from blowing up in the public markets. So a full 20% of the IPOs since 2000 have failed in their lead program, and much of it is due to safety. And so if that isn't proven out earlier, then the public investors are going to have a hard time touching that. So stay private as long as possible, and then when you have some sort of efficacy, that's the right time to go. The probably one exception to that is when you can have a look-through or a derivative trade where somebody is already public and has a product either on the market or has shown significant data in a particular mechanism, and you have the same mechanism but have a better profile. In that situation, people will look through, see that you're probably the same mechanism, and give you that credit if you can show better on the safety or convenience side.
I would just like to add that this is a cyclical phenomenon. It's not always going to stay. We're hopefully in a low point in the cycle. Things will change, and there will be a time when we'll have the opposite conversation. So not to dishearten too many people here, that's one thing. And the second thing is, if you have a great molecule, if you think you have an important insight in biology, you have a novel way to deliver the drug, you have a novel way to see nature that could be transformative, you must find ways to fund that. And on a very positive note, I would say that I still think there's enough capital in the world. Certainly at Fidelity, we'd love to meet with you, at least engage in that conversation, try to invest in the exceptional companies. And and as we discussed in the beginning, it's periods like this when the exceptional science, the exceptional leaders stand out. Those are the companies that do get funded. Those are the companies with the breakthrough science that's going to transform the landscape, and we're definitely open and welcoming to have those discussions and to engage deeply and do the due diligence. And if we can find a way to do it now, we'd love to do it. If not, it's a long journey. Paths will cross at another point. But we need to continue to stay deeply engaged and set a high bar.
Fantastic. That's a great closing statement. So we're out of time. I apologize to those that have been waiting to ask a question. We'll find other ways to communicate. I will just say in closing, you know, we had a peak for IO with PD-1. We're in a valley after that peak right now, which is not to say there will be no other peak. It's just a matter of time. And with what Rajiv just said, there is interest in pushing IO innovation. We will find a way to get there. So I will say one last thing. There is another panel dealing with an investment topic later this morning. It will be run by Jeff Bockman, and it will focus on transformational medicines, which is a nice segue from this one into another important topic. So thanks for your attention.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast. For more information on the IO 360 conference, editorial, podcasts, or webcasts, visit io360summit.com or theconferenceforum.org. Thanks for listening.